deities of other people. And that's the sense of the Bhagavad Gita. That's the sense of all the Oriental teachings, really. The gods are guides to something that we're all being guided to, namely the deep center of knowledge and truth and consciousness and life within ourselves, which is one with that within the world.
I think of the Tibetan Buddhist pantheon of gods and goddesses and deities, all representing a particular aspect of life.
Well, you see, in Tibet, as in certain other parts of the Orient, there was an enormous emphasis on meditation. And the degrees of meditation and the inflections of experience that come through meditation, and each of these inflections had a personification. And that's why you get this enormously complex pantheon, because it was an enormously complex tradition of inward experience. Whereas if you don't go inward like that and have all these varieties of experience, then such deities don't mean anything to you. The Tibetan pantheon in its fullness would not mean anything to a Western person because he hadn't had the counterpart experiences. But a monk who spent his whole life meditating, and then translating those into verbal and image statements is in tune with that pantheon.
Is there something of psychological understanding to be learned from that pantheon as relative, say, to our understanding of psychology in the West?
Well, for some of the major figures of the pantheon, that's true. But for the exquisite inflection, that's not true. There's a certain mistake in trying to become, let's say, a Tibetan or a Japanese or a Hindu if you are a Western person. What you ought to learn from them is to seek the equivalent mysteries in yourself. But then your own folk idea system has to come through. Everyone has to be creative in his own way, and one can lose oneself. Remember, I spoke earlier of entering the path where there was no path, you see, entering the forest where it was dark. When you enter someone else's path, you're apt to get displaced and achieve a false realization.
Yeah, when we look around, we see religion after religion, group after group, where there is a teacher and a disciple relationship, the teacher and the student. And this is the path, follow the path, do this, do it this way, meditate this way, meditate that way, pray this way, pray that way. You're suggesting that it should be otherwise.
I'm suggesting that it should be otherwise. I think you can take clues from teachers. I know you can. But you see, the traditional Oriental idea is that the student should submit absolutely to the teacher. The guru actually assumes responsibility for the student's moral life, and this is a total giving. I don't think that's quite proper for a Western person. I think one of the big spiritual truths of the West is that each of us is a unique creature and consequently has a unique path. You can take suggestions. I've gone in my life from one teacher to another, not mystery teachers, not spiritual teachers, but teachers in learning, and I leave them behind, just as we leave the music behind that we loved in our childhood for the music of later times, and each finding his own way. There are plenty of guides around, but none should be permitted to say, I'm it. Now, when Jesus and Krishna, in the text that you've just read, saying, all come only through me, what they're saying really is that they themselves represent that inward truth in oneself that must be found, and that is the gate. And I think if you read this concretely as meaning you've got to follow so-and-so, namely me, it's being misread. The me that they're talking to is the Christ in us, the God in us, and they're pointing toward it. There's that wonderful little Japanese Zen sign of the finger pointing to the moon. You must mistake the finger for the moon, and that the doctrine must not be mistaken and concretized and say, this is exactly it. It's not Jesus who's speaking, but Jesus Christ. The Christ is the second person of the Blessed Trinity, which is the knower of God the Father, and that's what's within us to be brought to life. As Paul could say, I live now, not I, but Christ in me. And so also Krishna can live in one.
Joseph, one of the things you've done in your life, and I never cease to be amazed at the volume of material that you've turned out through your hands in writing, and you edited the Portable Jung, and you put a lot of Jung's writings together, and you were just talking about how it's important to see our own uniqueness as Westerners and to come in touch with that and to perhaps learn from the East, but we also have our own individual understanding to realize and recognize. And I recall Jung visited the Taos Indians of New Mexico in the 20s when he was able to talk with some of the elders with their ancient understanding of who their gods were, and what an influence this had on Jung as a Westerner, as someone who was exploring the psyche in very deep ways. And I'd like you to talk about that.
Well, I can talk a little bit about my own experience of the American Indian world. It was through, as a young boy, reading American Indian stories and learning something about them, while I was at the same time being educated as a Roman Catholic, that I came to a realization that has stayed with me ever since. And it's a realization that I think can be well coordinated with my Catholic training, but it has a somewhat different emphasis. What I realized from the Indians was that all life was for them divine. The whole world was not simply the production of God, but was the actual manifestation of a divine power, the Wakan or Orenda or Manitou or whatever it was that was manifesting. And that wonderful thing that you learn when you read of the Indian sacred pipe ceremonial, where they hold the stem of the pipe up for the sun to smoke it first, and then present it to the four directions, and then bring it to themselves, and they have centered themselves in this divine world, a buffalo skull as a sacred object, the animal that is the source of their nourishment being itself a willing victim. And when they say their grace before meals, it's not to an image of God somewhere else thanking him for letting them kill this animal. It's to the animal for having given its life. You know, that wonderful I-thou relationship between the individual and the universe was to me a marvelous revelation and stays with me. And this was something that struck Jung also, as I recall from, I had a conversation with Jung, and I've also read a good deal of his own writings about things of this kind. It's something in quite a contrary position to that of the one who thinks, well, the divine is God out there, and he created the world, and the world is not God, but it's a manifestation of God's power and marvel and all that kind of thing. It's a different slant. But this got into me, and this, I think, is the mystical line, as opposed, rather, to the orthodox institutionalized religious position. It comes out also in that wonderful book that John Neihardt wrote, Black Elk Speaks, where Black Elk tells of a vision that he had had when he was 9 years old. It was a prophetic vision of what was going to happen to his people. But there's a moment there where he says, I saw myself standing on the central mountain of the world. The central mountain of the world is Harney Peak in South Dakota. And then immediately he said, but the central mountain is everywhere. Now, there is a man who understood symbolism, understood cult, and understood the reference. If you want to go to the central mountain of the world and you are a Sioux Indian, perhaps you should go to Harney Peak. But perhaps you should go to Jerusalem. Perhaps you should go to Rome. Perhaps you should go to Lhasa. Or perhaps you shouldn't go anywhere, but realize that the real central mountain is in yourself and that this is the cult symbol to put your mind in touch with the idea of a central mountain. Central mountain is the same as the immovable spot under which the Buddha sat. The central mountain is the same as the cross of Christ on the Mount of the Skull Calvary. This is the same thing, and it's right in yourself. That's where it is. This is what that man knew, that American Indian shaman. And it's this kind of wisdom that comes out of simple people, what seem to us to be simple people, non-literate people, non-complicated people, that can open your eyes to the teaching of your own most elaborate tradition, whatever it may be.